Freightonauts, we like to get where we're going. We like open ports, fast pipes, screaming IOPS, and crazy high transactions per second. That's good for us. It's good for our apps, and it's good for our users. Speed is good, so full speed ahead. But raw performance, as important as it is, shouldn't come at the expense of security when security is critical. Because, hey, sometimes apps face that nasty internet, and sometimes apps handle uber-sensitive data, and sometimes apps have big old targets painted on them. In that case, you need a secure computing platform. Our sponsor today, Skyport Systems, has built just such a secure computing platform. It's not a firewall, it's not an IPS, it's... Well, we're going to get into the details in just a bit, but before we do, let's introduce ourselves. I am Ethan Banks at EC Banks, and with me is my globetrotting co-host Chris Wall at Chris Wall. Joining us today from Skyport Systems is Doug Gourlay. Doug, please introduce yourself to the Datanauts audience.
Hi, everybody. This is Doug Gourlay from Skyport Systems. I look after the product management and kind of all the overall actually fun stuff of that, plus technology evangelism, and get to actually spend a lot of time with crazy guys like Ethan Banks and Chris Wall, which please don't judge me for that.
I think it's a great thing. What are you talking about?
There we go again. It's already started, folks. This is going to be a fun episode.
Well, Doug, we want to dive into the technology, of course, but it makes sense to take a few minutes to introduce Skyport because you guys are a startup, right?
Yeah, I guess we are. We've got about 85 to 100 employees. We're growing and we're building something innovative in the technology space that looks like it's continuing to solve really cool problems for customers. So yeah, I guess that qualifies us as a startup.
And do you mind talking about your founders just briefly? Because I remember meeting some of them at Tech Field Day, and it's kind of an impressive cast of folks.
Yeah, let's go through a little bit of the executive team. Our CEO is a gentleman named Art Gilliland. Art came to us via HP, where he headed up HP security, and before that ran the enterprise group over at Symantec. Our head of sales, Rick, also ran HP software sales with like thousands of sales reps and such. But the three founders on the technical side, Michael Beasley, spent a lot of time at Cisco and Juniper, where he was the enterprise CTO for all the enterprise routing group. Will Etherton built the backplane architecture on the CRS-1 router at Cisco and later ran engineering for the T-Series and PTX at Juniper Networks. And Rob Rogers, it's really hard to go into detail on Rob. You know how every sort of security-focused company has that one incredibly uber-paranoid person who sometimes wears tinfoil hats? That's Rob. I love him dearly, but there are the days where occasionally, you know, we do want to leave a tinfoil hat at his desk. Rob was a distinguished engineer at both Cisco and Juniper and really is sort of the moral compass on the technology side of us as a business and making sure that we're building a product where security is first and not an afterthought. That's kind of it for the founding team. Yeah, it's a really interesting group of folks who came from a wide variety of backgrounds, so network side, system side, security side. Really what we set out to build was a secure infrastructure platform. We've talked a lot in the past about converged systems, and we've seen the convergence of network and computing. We've seen the convergence of storage and computing. And what we're really doing is bringing about that convergence of security with computing at a platform level of approach, of one that's designed to be turnkey and easy and simple to use for our customers, rather than becoming a mishmash of 50 to 100 different vendors and putting that burden of integration on our customers and consumers.
Absolutely. I watched semi-recently the video even on the front of your page where your CEO, Art, was delivering what is the company kind of in a nutshell. And I was actually pretty pleased the fact that at the end of the video, although I've seen what you've done with the Field Day crowd, I kind of knew what you were talking about. You address things like use cases and folks that are using the product. Do you have any kind of flagship customers that you can talk about that are today customers of Skyport?
Gosh, yes. Of course I do. I'll pick a couple. We have customers in the university space like Auburn University, who uses our product to host mobile device management platforms. We have customers like Rambus, who've used us in the DMZ for securing file transfer. We have some large Fortune 500 banking institutions who are a little less likely to let you have a customer reference. Sure, and the application there are things like one of our real core focus use cases is around Active Directory and hardening the Active Directory infrastructure. Now, really, it's solving a key problem. And the key problem we've seen in an AD environment is that Active Directory is almost always its own authentication source for administrative access. A lot of us came from a networking background and we're familiar with RADIUS and TACACS. Some people have even taken RADIUS and TACACS and used that proxying to Active Directory for single sign-on. right? So that they manage the user accounts in one place. But other customers have said, let's keep it segregated so that we have a separate account for administration of the network infrastructure than we do for login to the user environment. When you have an AD environment where you have the thing providing authentication is also the thing granting administrative access, you have a vicious circular dependency. Mm-hmm. You can kind of see where I'm going with this, right? Which is,
right.
I steal a credential in an AD environment, and next thing you know, I can use that credential to create further administrative accounts. And then those accounts, especially if I'm connecting it to Radius and TACX, the theft of an administrative account actually gives a level of control that says I can access almost every file, every machine, every application, therefore all the data, the VPN, the firewall policies, IDS, IPS, logging, and so on. In short, I have the level of administrative access necessary to fully compromise an enterprise, destroy it, and erase the footprints that I was ever there. So we need to break that kill chain. We need to understand the scope of administration and then lock that environment down so that the method of gaining administrative access is decoupled from the general purpose methods of authentication in the enterprise. That's kind of how that project has worked. It became one of our signature use cases. The other is out-of-compliance applications, and by that I mean older versions of Windows XP 2000, 2003 that are consistently failing scans that cost $250,000 to rewrite the application, and we're able to go in and quickly remediate those, eliminating the attack surface of it, not just at a ports and IP address level, but within the protocol itself by doing application layer proxies. For instance, within port 443, denying SSL v2, v3, and TLS 1.0, terminating those inside our compartment, and then upgrading that to TLS 1.2, hosting the certificate off of an HSM. That's an example of what we do on a specific protocol for an application that we're hosting, providing that secure perimeter for. And that's something that, you know, traditional micro-segmentation platforms don't go to that application layer, that cryptographic level, to support for their customers. They talk broadly about attack surface. We talk deeply about attack surface.
You've got customers. You've got some use cases that these customers are taking advantage of. One more quick question, just as kind of the setup of who is Skyport and what you guys are doing. Are you selling direct right now, or are you working with channel partners for people that are looking at the solution?
We're 100% channel focused, 100% channel fulfilled. In fact, our channel chief, Phil Alexander, just won like the channel chief of the year on that top list at Computer Reseller Network. And I think that is recognition of the fact that, you know, we're a channel-led company. There's a lot of good reasons for that. But one of the key ones is, especially in the mid-market and through mid-enterprise, where we've seen a lot of our volume uptake of customers, it's a channel-led world. And it's one where you need the channel partner to be at the table and understand the platform and be able to convey the value of that platform to a customer. You don't want to compete with your channel partners for customer access or for customer fulfillment.
Well, Chris, now that we're thinking about Skyport, we understand a little bit about who they are as a company. One of the things that stuck out to me was they are channel-led. I like the way Doug put that. I mean, to me, that means that Skyport is already set to scale their delivery and integration work. So as many customers as they want to pick up, they've got channel partners that can support that infrastructure, which is kind of a big deal. A lot of startups don't do channel out of the gate. They kind of play it safe and conservative, and then demand picks up and they struggle, and then they have to convert to channel, and that's hard. Skyport's already over that hurdle.
Absolutely. I think that's a good strategy. You know, it's one I've seen done by some of the smarter startups for sure. And the thing I was thinking about was hearing that they've got the security guy with the tinfoil hat that kind of rubs him a little bit of a friction here or there. And quite frankly, he's doing his job. We want that guy that's always looking over your shoulder and making sure that things are secure. He's got your back, especially if your company's focused on security. So I salute you, tinfoil hat man. Keep wearing it with pride.
Doug, we've got a good overview of who Skyport is as a company. We've got the big idea here that customers are using the product for some very specific use cases, interesting things they've already figured out how to do with it. For the engineering audience that's listening here, let's get into how this sucker works. I mean, in a nutshell, can you describe the product itself? Not the use cases, but just what is this thing that we're buying?
Sure. There's three core parts to the system. The first and probably the most important is that the system creates a policy enforcement point. You could call this a software-defined perimeter, or a network edge that wraps directly around a virtual machine. The purpose of this is that the historical problem with firewalls is that there's a human on the wrong side of it. The reason you see phishing attacks and such as the most prevalent way of getting into an enterprise is it defeats the firewall. So we wanted to create a perimeter that's as close to a workload as possible, yet does not touch it. So we didn't have to embed agents and such inside of it.
But again, Skyport Systems is not a firewall. It is creating a perimeter, but you're actually hosting the VMs yourself on this infrastructure, yeah?
Right. And we're going to get to that. But the first part starts with a perimeter. Understanding that perimeter and what it lets you do is the perimeter is a set of application layer proxies. They work on domain name and DNS zone. They work at web applications with crypto and credential proxies. And like we had indicated in the first part, upgrade SSL to TLS 1.2 with strong cipher suites. Identity management proxies handling NTLM to Kerberos, administrative privilege access proxies for SSH and RDP, file system proxies handling SIFS, NFS, SMB, Ceph, S3, and so on.
So if I'm an application that's sitting on a Skyport Systems box, I've got to go through one of these application proxies to access those critical services?
Exactly. And that creates like a cell, a private space for that application to run in, where we control all access in and out at the application layer. Now, proxies have traditionally been very powerful technologies that have been very effective, but the problem has historically been that of performance. You take a 40-gig firewall, turn the proxy functions on, it becomes a 2-gig firewall.
Yes.
And it's right, and it's a 2-gig firewall shared across tens to hundreds to thousands of systems. This is specific to that single virtual machine. And so the blast radius of any performance impact is only the application using that particular feature set. That's very important from performance management of the applications. Let's talk to the next part, which is that we host the application. Absolutely. The second part and the first supporting element of this software perimeter is we build a hardware platform. This is an x86 system domestically manufactured by one of our key investors, Intel, that we've then integrated a custom-designed security coprocessor. Analogy, think of it as a 40-gig firewall on a NIC. What it does is that's where the proxies run. This means that there's zero performance degradation that's experienced by the application on the x86 side because all of that processing runs in a separate coprocessor.
Yep. Okay. Yep. You've offloaded that completely. So you have the full functionality at line rate with no impact to where the VMs themselves execute.
Correct.
So this is a hardware platform with some very special offload capabilities to it that runs a hypervisor of some sort, and the workloads on top of there are my applications that you're surrounding with your software perimeter as such?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, I can send you a really cool graphic we could flash on the screen at this moment, maybe. There we go. Right. And if that happens, that'll be amazing. If it doesn't, just visualize it for me. It's amazing. Okay. There's a website which has pictures. The other thing that happens with that, though, is that secure coprocessor and the x86 side, we've shrunk and reduced the attack surface from it. There's no IPMI or ILO. There's no USBs. There's no KVM. There's no direct console. In short, we reduce the physical attack surface on that element, and then we execute a trusted boot with all signature signed and validated software. Net of it is we build a secure foundation for hosting that application and for ensuring the integrity of that software perimeter. This defeats those low-level attacks, the really malicious ones that we've seen executed at large banks like rootkits and low-level malware, corrupted SSD firmware attacks, and so on. It defeats those by intelligent software verification at the lowest levels in the system.
Okay, Doug, you know the question I'm going to ask based on that is...
Hit me.
ILO, CIMC, et cetera. That's how I manage my environment and do automation, typically against these out-of-band management ports. If you don't have any of those... What do I do now? How does my life change?
Sure. By the way, did you see the attack that was posted to Reddit a couple weeks ago that happened on a Supermicro system?
I did not.
Oh my gosh. I will send you the URL. This is incredible. What happened is on a Supermicro server, if you do not plug in the ILO port, it tries to reach out over the internet on the in-band data ports, opening up ports 80 and 443 to inbound administrative request with, get this, the username and password is admin admin.
I do know that. I know it's admin all caps because that's more secure than lowercase.
And it opened up ports 80, 443, 22, and 623, all with default creds for inbound admin. So,
excuse me, I need to go change some passwords real quick. I'll be right back.
You're welcome. IPMI is a great technology. It's an incredibly awesome backdoor. We built all of the management for the system and treating it as an appliance into the third part of the system, which is a central management attestation and logging and forensics service. Okay, so for most mid-market through mid-enterprise, we run it as a cloud service. For the most cloud unfriendly of our customers, we deliver it on-prem, right? And what this does is a couple things. One, all administrative access is controlled, separately authenticated. We handle attestation of the system, which is where we verify the trusted platform modules and all software is valid as it's delivered to the system. All software delivery, all BIOS delivery, all firmware delivery. The system's measured in manufacturing and constantly remeasured every 8 hours throughout its life cycle. Additionally, and probably most importantly, we log every packet in or out, every administrative session, every operational activity on virtual machines we're hosting, all DNS lookups, and so on, and all policy changes within the system. This means that I can look at any given system and go back 2 years and say in June of 2014 at 1 o'clock in the morning on a specific date, who created the policies for a given virtual machine at that time that allowed specific file transfer activities to go out to specified destinations?
2 years and you're logging every packet and a whole lot of other information. Where is all that data living?
It's in the cloud, baby. Which by the cloud, we mean somebody else's computer. And by that, we mean our computers. We built the administrative and management system on top of a multi-tenant Hadoop cluster, Druid stream processing system, discrete HSMs for key management. The keys for all the data are in the customer's hands and that are then unlocked when the customer authenticates and accesses it. We actually have no access to the customer data unless they specifically grant us access for troubleshooting and customer success purposes. But you know, it goes on and on. It's a very, very detailed and articulated system that's designed to protect the integrity of the customer's data.
And that's all part of the package. In other words, it's kind of nice you haven't put the burden on the customer to provide terabytes and terabytes, et cetera, of storage to house all this stuff. You just take care of that for them,
right,
as a part of the deal.
Yeah, I mean, how many times do you buy, I'm not going to pick on them, I'm using it as an example, I actually like the product, but like VMware AirWatch, right? You buy VMware AirWatch and they go, it's a great package. But then it says, oh, and we need a SQL database with an ODBC connection so we can put a multi-terabyte data store to it.
Exactly. And that's when you get people going, it's going to be admin, and it's local on my LAN, so no one can get to it anyways. And it's just out there and it's passed along as tribal knowledge where just each next admin knows what the password is. And who would want to change and manage all of that? I managed a 1100 server environment. I didn't bother changing any of that stuff. It would be an administrative nightmare. So this sounds like a huge value add.
Yeah. So we try to make it turnkey, right? Because the average enterprise today has 35 to 50 security technologies. And in networking, we had Cisco. In computing, you had Intel, and those forced de facto standards that people had to integrate with in order to be a player in the market. There's been no single dominant company in security large enough to force a de facto or de jure integration and set of integration standards across technologies. So that's where we've seen the stratification of 50 plus tools, no integration. And people go, oh, well, we just connected to our SIM system, which is a great technology, but look at SIM systems, right? They receive log files and do some analysis and then display perceived threats and things you should focus on. But do you realize the method of integration into a SIM system 9 times out of 10 is syslog? And syslog is not sequence numbered, is not signature signed, is not encrypted. It is not guaranteed delivery. So on those four things, you go garbage in, garbage out. How do I know I actually got the data I'm supposed to get into my platform that's supposed to provide integration? We use almost a blockchain model for our log structure where all the logs are signature signed. They're all guaranteed delivery method using a protocol buffers, message passing system. They're all encrypted on a per tenant basis, and they're all stored in an immutable log structure. The client can't even delete their own logs. So the rogue admin insider can't delete the footprints of the stupid thing they did to try to steal data, leave back doors, or so on.
Okay, Doug, let's take a second and just recap here. So we've got a box. The box is hardware secured in a variety of ways that you talked about. And the box also has a series of application proxies that creates a secure perimeter. So I've got a secure bit of hardware, secure perimeter. Now I put a VM in it that's got to go through that. I've now got this secure environment in which I can run the box, run my VMs. And now management. How do I manage this infrastructure? We were just talking about logs and so on, but there's so much more here going on in my brain. Because this isn't running VMware. This is your own thing. So that means I got to, you know, how do I integrate this thing into my operations and so on?
Sure. Two aspects to that. Well, really three. The first is let's talk about the targeted workloads, right? The use case we brought up earlier about, like, say, Active Directory. Listen, about who really admins an Active Directory environment? And I'm going to take you off again. We're going to go off-roading for a second here, but you have your assigned admin. This is the enterprise admin, domain admin for the forest, right? Okay, great. Well, who else is actually capable of becoming an administrator, whether or whether or not you've granted them the access to do it intentionally? Well, the person with access to the hypervisor has all of the system access capable of stealing and becoming an administrator. Anyone with physical access to your server hardware has the same level of access. Anyone who has access to a node that exists on the IPMI or management network based on a lot of the well-publicized CVEs and lack of maintenance we all do on upgrading ILO port BIOSes and such has that level of access. Anyone who does tape rotations to the backups of the domain controller has that level of access. And anyone who could send an email that's actually open on the administrative workstation also has that same discrete level of access. So the first thing we did is said, who is an admin? Well, it's all of those. So how do we create an administrative environment that applies discrete compensating controls against each one of those six methods of administrative access into our system? We built that type of environment that purposefully segregates the administrative control and authentication for the nodes under us from the other platforms, which have too often opened unplanned for levels of access to the applications that were being hosted on them or had access to them. So that's very, very purposeful. What does this mean in practicality? You don't have to manage the hypervisor on our system. It's part of the system. You don't have to manage backups. That's integrated. There is no IPMI or ILO. So we built a full UI that provides systems level, policy and security level, network level administration, visibility, and control into the system for the functions necessary to support the types of use cases I've been describing. However, recognizing that larger shops, especially some of the service providers we've been working with, have full automation tools, whether these are Salt, Chef, Puppet, Ansible, and so on, our UI is built on top of a structured API that we've shared with our larger customers to do direct integration with the system. And that gives the flexibility to the larger customers who want to do full runbook automation integration with the system. It also allows them to use the UI. It allows us to integrate with the CM system of their choice to generate alerts and alarms through that single pane of glass they're probably already using in the SOC. And then from there, drive down into the UI of our system to gather the level of forensics and data necessary to inform the decision on change of InfoSec policy, whether that's quarantining something or a human resources action.
Everything's going through that API then, even your own GUI.
Absolutely. There's nothing we do in the GUI that's not exposed to a customer through the API.
That's the way everything should be. And I like the idea of lifecycle management as either a more enterprise-y type environment or an SP where I can plug into your API and make those same kind of calls, because RESTful API calls are, once you've done it with a couple products, it becomes pretty second nature. The fact that they can plug in and do that work the same way they're already doing it, to me, is just, that's the way we have to do things today. There's no way to scale it with the manual click, click, pull the lever.
Yeah, exactly right. And the thing is, we wanted to provide a separate administrative environment that breaks that administration of authentication kill chain for several discrete workloads. I want to be very, very clear. Our system is not designed to run 100% of the workloads of an enterprise. To be very candid, we're probably not designed to run 10% of the workloads with an enterprise. There's a couple percent, right? It is the Active Directory environment, the out-of-compliance workloads, the DNS infrastructure, the certificate authorities, the critical infrastructure nodes that are control points within that environment. It could also be the things that get attacked a lot, like the DMZ devices, right? Where, you know, one of our customers we're working with has literally over 200 discrete DMZs. Each DMZ has physically separate firewalls, IDS, IPS, gigamons, and servers. Well, because of the level of confidentiality and security and segregation they need. But this means that with zero resource sharing, not even at a VLAN level, There's no ability to scale up or scale down a DMZ without physically going into the data center and giving more access to some of the lower level people to do ads, moves, and changes. We are able to work with them to create an environment consolidating those DMZ architectures into a common suite of compute and network access infrastructure that allows them to dynamically repurpose resources into different DMZs, yet have discrete policy, discrete authentication, discrete keying for each one of those DMZ structures.
Mm. And as you build out the framework, does it look like one logical kind of cluster, or are they different nodes that I manage individually, or do I get to choose?
You actually get to choose, because in this scenario, like for instance, retail banking and associated retail properties may fall under a single enterprise with common hardware. However, something for institutional, right, might be a discrete enterprise with dedicated hardware that by design will not host a workload within retail. It puts a freedom of choice within the customer's environment. Probably the most important thing, you know, to kind of, again, a little bit of a probably philosophical waxing. We always say that security is about people, process, and technology. And one of the fundamental issues I've discovered is, and it's probably been well known forever, I'm not like, you know, an inventor here, but it's that the problem we've historically have is there's a process you want to implement. So there's a set of policies you write. But if technology doesn't reinforce that policy and reinforce those processes, it will defeat them. So what we realized we had to do was create a set of technology that let a customer create the policies they want and enforce those policies onto the people that are running it. So that the admin, for instance, can't administer the server without going through the jump host. If the admin tries to go in and create an inbound RDP session authorized from his desktop because he doesn't want to use the jump host or doesn't want to go to the secure admin workstation, we will deny
that never
it.
Yeah.
Right. And what we'll do is deny it. Not just deny it, but deny it and log it. And then the SecOps team will look at it and go, so wait a second, Bob. You didn't want to use the SAW. You didn't want to use the jump host. So you tried to open an inbound RDP proxy session from your desktop?
Or it's not him doing it, and it's something rogue, and you just caught a potential breach, and it's logged, so we know, even though that person has the admin credentials because they're on his desktop, something fishy is going on. Although right. I'd hate to be Bob at that point, because I do that all the time.
Right. Well, think about it. Right there, you just nailed one of the key things about the capability that we bring to market, which is when you couple, let's say, this inbound RDP proxy with the level of visibility of knowing where every virtual machine is, which ones are virtual secure admin workstations, what are the physical SAWs in the environment, you can create a workflow where a traditional switch, router, firewall, ACL, IP set, IP table type of infrastructure, a low-level layer 3, layer 4 infrastructure, would look at an inbound RDP attempt. And let's say it would intelligently deny it because it wasn't coming from the right place. You're going to see about 400 bytes of data, about 25, 30 packets, and they're dropped. And you'll see that source IP to dest IP, inbound, this port and protocol, this amount of traffic dropped. That's valuable. It's good that it dropped it, no question. Shrunk the attack surface. But it's really about creating a more intelligent attack surface. An attack surface where when you see that inbound RDP request, you don't just drop it. You tease it along for a little bit. You say, is the credential valid? Did two-factor check out? What machine are you? What user account did you use? What groups was it in? And then you deny that bad actor. So the report you get says that user Ethan, coming in from his desktop, didn't use the jump host, but passed two-factor authentication, and then we denied it. You know what? The first time, you might get wrist slapped. By the third time, you might get terminated, right? But take a different tack. What if Chris's account failed two-factor authentication while coming in from Ethan's laptop? Probably worth quarantining it. Probably not an HR action. You can gather enough information to accurately inform the right SecOps response because you've gathered enough information and you've sensed enough data to be able to make sense out of it and then be able to take the appropriate action.
How do you draw the line between prevention and detection? So you tried a lot of things that you can detect very intelligently and then drop something. But then is there also remediation that goes beyond that? Because you mentioned handing off to SecOps at some point. When does that happen?
Well, we've built a visual whitelisting model into the system. This allows us, one, to see all the traffic in or out, and then use this visual model to then drive policy instantiation or policy enforcement. So we would be able to see the traffic, for instance, that was violating the whitelist and was being dropped. We actually now can not only drop it, we can PCAP it. So our IO controller, security coprocessor, has a hardware packet capture capability integrated. So you know how like switches and routers you would drop and count? firewalls, you drop count log. We actually drop count log and capture. So you can get a Wireshark PCAP dump of the data that was dropped by the policy layer. Now, I can use that to adjust policy. I might find that here's an application trying to reach out to windowsupdate.com that I should be allowing to reach out to windowsupdate.com, and then make a conscious decision to allow it. By the way, you'd also find a scenario where somebody left the auto update on in an application and it was trying to reach out to not the local Windows Update services it was supposed to, but the global one hosted by Microsoft. And in that scenario, you may go back and just simply have a conversation with the app developer. Hey, you pushed a new version of code because we saw it. You restarted the VM because we saw that. And now right after a restart, it's reaching out somewhere it's not supposed to reach out to. So the first job of making sense of data is to sense the data itself. So you got to capture it. You then have to have the tooling in place to allow customers to be able to see what's going on and drill down into it. That's what we've been delivering. But we know that we're not going to have the be-all, end-all tool set. So we're opening that up to third-party analytics packages as well. That's what part of that API structure enables us to do.
I want to talk about your policy engine or the ability to apply policy to a workload real quick. The question is, once a VM is brought up and it's instantiated on Skyport, what kind of communication policies are in place and how do I build policy? How do I apply it? Describe the life of the policy within your framework.
Sure. What I've generally found, so there's, you know, the sort of panacea model that we all expected people to do, and we're probably wrong. And there's what people are actually doing. So let me actually talk through what people are actually doing. We found in general that most people have no clue whatsoever about what their applications actually do, right? Especially outside of like some very specific governmental environments, very, you know, discrete applications. They usually have no idea what the thing does. The developer actually doesn't understand at a network socket's perspective what it does either. In reality, what happens is we import a workload into us and we put it into an open sort of learning slash observation mode. We can put it into a firewall mode, which would allow outbound and not accept inbound, or we can put it into a wide open mode. Usually what we do is we put in wide open mode while in a lab environment or a test environment, and we let the application run for 24 to 72 hours, no different with no policy changes to the existing infrastructure it had previously been running on. And we monitor it. We log it, we learn, and we create a graphical visualization of all the traffic, source, desk, port, protocol, time of day, inbound, outbound, so on and so forth. We then use that data to inform the creation of a whitelist. We then create that whitelist. We let the application continue to run. And then we enforce the whitelist. And I would usually recommend turning on the packet capture at that point for any misses. And in the first couple days, hours, tracking it and making sure that if there's any misses, they're really things that you intended to drop or they're sort of collateral damage, something you forgot to whitelist. And you go back and adjust that. At that point, most business applications, and the really good thing about them, is they're not nearly as fluid and weird as users are. If a business application that's supposed to do, I don't know, creating the executive dashboard for the daily close of the financials of the business, it's probably not going to change the information access methods that it uses on a daily, monthly, or even quarterly basis. Once it's working, it tends to have a common set of data inputs and data outputs and stick with those. So the amount of change you have in that environment is relatively limited. In fact, it's generally incredibly limited. For those older out-of-compliance applications and the Active Directory environments and so on, they're pretty static once they're up and running. So the amount of monitoring it takes once you have a solid policy is very minimal. The ongoing maintenance tends to be at that point around things like continuously upgrading crypto libraries against the, you know, ever-changing suite of attacks and gaps we find in those crypto libs. And those are things that plus BIOS, plus firmware, plus low-level hypervisors and such are things that we automatically do for our customers and in our continuous delivery model are generally updated within 48 hours of a CVE being published. We make that new code available to the customer, and with one click, the package gets downloaded. The workloads migrate, they get upgraded, they can migrate back, and are backed up and restored, and you're off to the races. So, you know, we really view that continuous delivery of software as a key differentiator for maintaining the security posture in the face of the type of threat landscape we're consistently seeing in the wild today.
Mm-hmm. I gotta admit, I was pretty surprised hearing about the idea of wiping the slate clean of all of the traditional out-of-band management interfaces. It blew my mind because I've long since used IPMI and ILO and SIMC and everything else they're used for remote hands management, config management. A lot of times that's how you get to some kind of API or scriptable interface. But this is interesting. We now have an immutable source of secure logs and a secure system that isn't just the admin/admin on a default port. That's awesome, and I can see a lot of value in having that provided for you as a way to administer, manage, and really do the remote configuration of the system.
As a former security guy, I've done a good bit of firewall work and IPS, IDS work over the years. I liked the notion of an intelligent attack service. I think that is a fabulous idea. Because it's one thing to detect some sort of anomalous behavior, either a signature that matched or something like that. But there's never much more behind it other than a flag that gets raised. So this intelligent attack surface, what I took away from it is it's not just detection, but it's also behavioral analysis. You get tooling to examine the issue, and a full packet capture is there, so you've got a detailed record of the event. You get integration with third-party analytical tools. Since their whole system is API-driven, you can do that. And the end result is you get a deeper understanding of what really happened, and then you can construct an appropriate response.
Well, we've gone over what Skyport is, who they are, and how the technology works. We've fleshed out a little bit about use cases, but I think this would be a great time to go much deeper into the use cases. And one that was brought up that I wanted to tease apart at a kind of a deeper discussion first, Doug, is the hosting of those out-of-compliance systems. You mentioned some older operating systems, applications that aren't behaving well. Maybe they're kind of long in the tooth, but the idea of rewriting them or replatforming them is just super difficult. So can you flesh apart kind of what that use case looks like and what people are doing with it?
Sure. When we say an out-of-compliance workload, it could be out of compliance with your own company's policy. It could be out of compliance with a specific regulatory requirement. Both of those tend to be, you know, in IT, especially in SecOps, I mean, to be really kind of, again, a little blunt, you oftentimes don't have the budget to do what you need to do. But you fail an audit and budget somehow magically rains from the sky. So people have often failed audit or breaches as the raison d'etre to go do something. One of the more common methods that auditors and pen testers and these guys doing these tests against you will do is they'll come in with a tool like Nessus and they'll scan your environment. If you took a Windows 2003, even up through a 2012 R2 clean ISO build, and it wasn't behind anything protecting it special, and you scan it, you're going to get a laundry list of medium to critical severity issues. Things like my personal two favorites in Microsoft land are MS-14-66, that's a vulnerability in S-channel, which could allow remote code execution, or 1534, which is a vulnerability in HTTP.sys, which could allow remote code execution. Literally 1466 is in like Windows 2000, 2003, 2008, 2012 R2, and so on and so forth by default in an unpatched version. Mediums, you'll find things like the SSL cert can't be trusted, weaker RC4 cipher suites are supported, what they call the bar mitzvah attack, SMB signing's not in place, terminal services doesn't use NLA, so on. There's a bunch of bad hygiene things that exist. When the auditor sees this laundry list of, you know, reds, oranges, and yellow errors, they will fail that particular thing. And you need to, in a newer version of software, go patch it. But on an older version, something like Windows 2000 or 2003, the patches might not even be available, or you may not have the extended service contract that allows those patches to be available to you. And that's where you find this problem. Oftentimes, again, a little historical waxing, in Windows 2000 land and 2003 land, think about that time frame. You had the dot-com meltdown happen a year or two before. Developers flooded the enterprise market looking for jobs, and they were good developers. They built applications that solved business problems. The business said, we need you to develop in Windows. So they built on Windows 2003, the latest at the time, probably on .NET 2 or .NET 2.5, which unfortunately at that time was fairly tightly coupled to the underlying operating system. What this means is that fast forward 13 years, you have a business application people still know how to use. It works. They like it. It's valuable. It's now not supported by the operating system vendor or even the development framework it ran on. It used older versions of SSL, older versions of NTLM authentication, and so on that have exposed significant critical security flaws. What's it take to rebuild it? I mentioned they were tightly coupled. Sometimes it's up to $250,000 per application to rewrite that application to bring it forward for the same baseline capability it already has to run on a newer version of an operating system. And a lot of folks look at that and go, I can't afford in my limited budget $250,000 to rewrite an application to do the same thing it did before and just eliminate some checkboxes that piss some auditor off. So what have we done? We, by putting that wrapper around the application, we mask what it's doing on the inside from what it's doing on the outside. And literally on a Nessus scan against clean ISO builds of 2012 R2, 08, 03, 2000, we can share this data with you or put it up for customers. You can see the before and after. And the after looks like all the highs are gone, all the lows are gone, all the mediums are gone, all the criticals are gone. And you're left with the general informative information that Nessus is gathering from the workload. In fact, when it looks at it, what's my favorite is OS identification. It thinks that a Windows workload is a Linux workload. And that's a thing of beauty for us. Right? There's a word in the SecOps community of deception. And what it's doing is you will attack it wrongly. And if you attack it wrong because you've identified it wrong, you're going to use something that trips one of the whitelists. You're going to make a mistake. And then you're going to be caught. Right? So part of prevention is deception. Essentially what we do in that environment. Now, the cost structure is what's really important. A single one of our boxes over a three-year horizon hosting 10, you know, can host 10 to 12 or more virtual machines, like a fully loaded 2012 R2 build running a business app or 2003 app or so on. And so literally your per application cost is like for $7,500 over 3 years, I can lock this application down and not have to go back and remediate it. Now, I had one guy look at me and go, that's the most evil thing I've ever heard. And I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, well, I really, really, really want the developers to migrate it forward. And you're giving them a way that they don't have to. And I'm like, and part of me kind of feels bad about that, right? But we also have to accept the reality that there's a set of applications where the guy who wrote it might not even be part of the business anymore, not after 13 years. And sometimes you just need to take that final 100, 200 applications you can't get ported forward and come up with a way to remediate it and solve the tactical issue for yourself. That's one of the key use cases for us.
Doug, let me ask you about the DMZ use case again. You talked about that a bit, talked about a customer who had a large number of DMZs they needed to deal with, and you gave them a better way to do that. I was thinking about this. Do I even need a firewall exactly with Skyport? What is the recommended architecture you guys deploy?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is if you look at our three strategic investors, Google Ventures, Cisco, and Intel, Google doesn't use firewalls in production IT. They've stated publicly they push the fire, they push the security perimeter as close to that workload as possible and gather as much data there as possible to inform subsequent policy and segmentation changes and such. That's effectively a model that we enable for the enterprise. And I think, you know, I don't want to speak for them, but I believe that's part of the reason for that investment, was they view that the model we enable the enterprise to do strongly parallels the model that they do for their commercial and production IT systems.
So you're really confirming it. It is plausible. It is a reasonable consideration to build a DMZ environment on Skyport that doesn't have a firewall necessarily. You've done all the hardening. The layer 7 inspections are there. All of the port inbound and outbound governing is there. It's all tied by policy back to the workload. It's all audited and logged heavily. So at that point, if you're trying to stick a Skyport box because it looks like a server to you inside of a DMZ because that's the construct you're used to and you've been doing it for 20 years, why are you doing that at that point? I think it's a question really worth asking.
Yeah. I mean, I got to tell you, I've seen in the last 2 years that I've been here looking at 100, 150 customers' infrastructures now, I've seen things that are just egregious. When you think about it, I saw a customer who has production IT running on VMware. Thumbs up, great move, guys. By the way, their DMZ is using the same vCenter because then they don't have to deploy a new vCenter.
Yeah, it's easier, you know, less money, right. Blah, 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 yeah.
Which means that their vCenter is connecting into that security zone of that DMZ, and it's a two-way pipe. Things like that are just, they're scary, they're a little appalling, and by the way, they're using like iSCSI to reach out back into the core of the data center because that's how they were doing backups off of these DMZ servers. And it's a common data store that's used by other production IT systems on the inside of the firewall. It happens to be the same data store that's hosting critical IP. And this is like a semiconductor company, right? So I've seen this kind of thing time and time again. And it comes back to that, who's an admin? And in the DMZ, we can provide a closed environment integrates backup, integrates management, integrates virtualization, integrates administrative authentication, integrates forensics and logging into a common set of systems that are purposefully designed to be facing the nastiest environment in the world. And I'll tell you what we did. This is kind of fun. Right now, today, we are hosting Microsoft Active Directory open on the internet with no firewall, no IDS, no IPS. And for part of a red team test, I gave the customer day one, no access. Their pen test team has not been able to get in. Day two, we gave them user accounts on a member server that was part of that domain. Still weren't able to get in. Day three, we gave them enterprise admin and domain admin credentials. Still couldn't get in. Day four, we now have given them a golden ticket, literally an EA credential with a 10-year lifetime. We gave them access to the member servers. We've given them access to client machines that are connecting to the member servers and the domain controller. And still, so far, they've not been able to penetrate that system that's open on the internet with no firewalls, no other IDS, no special segmentation, two ports, 10 gig connected to the wide open internet.
I'm just imagining a dozen people in the phone booths from the Hackers movie with the, you know, Diet Mountain Dews and pizzas trying to get in this thing, black circles in their eyes, like, why can't we get in? You know, just totally frustrated.
Yeah. And you know what? There's a couple interesting things. You know, I've talked to some folks in the sort of white hat, black hat community. They've all said hardware is hard. We go to where it's easy. We go to the guys who make the mistakes. By the time it's a hardware system, they said, we're not going to buy one of your servers and one of your compute systems and your entire infrastructure to try to reverse engineer it and find a backdoor. It's not worth it.
But you don't steal from the ATM, right? You steal from the bank electronically.
Or you steal from the ATM by putting a skimmer on the outside.
Yeah, the skimmer on it for sure. You don't try to like break it open with wire crackers or something. Yeah.
It was comical, by the way. I heard of a red team who did crack an ATM machine open and reset the router. And in resetting one of the routers, you and I know the process. Boom, change 2102 to 2142 in the registers, and I have root access.
Mm-hmm.
So executing password recovery on a distributed router for itself, and then questioning, does the router run signature signed code or not? If the answer is no, can you insert your own rootkits and shims into it? Very interesting thesis.
I'm just going to use Apple Pay for everything. Sorry.
Nothing wrong with that, man. I love NFC. But now, you know, what you're alluding to is in that DMZ, it's facing the scariest section of the world. And, you know, you want to ensure that it has very controlled access inside and a strong protective wall outside. It has all the tripwires in place. So if it ever tries to do something off-roading, even a little bit, you catch it. You need to control administrative access in and out of those platforms. You need to force the use of jump hosts and SAWs and such, and you don't want it to share infrastructure with things that are inside of your enterprise.
So, Doug, we talked about three different use cases here significantly. We spent time on hosting out-of-compliance systems, the DMZ environments, hosting Active Directory. Well, what are the other major use cases that Skyport's been applied to so far?
Honestly, that's probably the big ones. You know, that we've danced around a couple of things. One that I really, it's sort of nascent for us, and again, kind of credit to our buddies, Brett and John Willis, and that's at hardening that software delivery lifecycle, really ruggedizing that DevOps environment, creating that secure platform for the production DevOps environment to engage on that allows us to apply policies against those VMs or containers in a model that ensures that you have security and agility in parallel for the production runs out of that DevOps environment.
So they're still able to stand up new applications, do their continuous integration, a constant release cycle, but have it be stood up in a secure environment in an automated way where it's not a big headache every time they push a new code out there.
Right. Well, and imagine that last step of the production push is an API call to us that applies an existing security template against that new workload. And it's a template that SecOps has signed off on. If they can't select a template, then it stays in a pre-production state, not able to have external or critical system access until such a time as SecOps plus DevOps have created and aligned on a template that's then applied to it.
Got it. Makes sense.
Like I say, that's a very nascent space, right? I mean, there's a lot of things going on. There's a lot of interesting developments out there. And we're not going to be the be-all, end-all solution on that. I mean, we're going to integrate with other companies, maybe it's the Apseras of the world or so on, to build solutions that solve that problem at multiple levels. Well, really, I think the optimization we all have to do is preserving that agility in the workflow, yet recognizing that at certain points in the life cycle, you need to apply policy to those before it can cause damage. The other thing that's very key, I talked about the proxies. One of the things we proxy are credentials. This can include API keys. This means that, for instance, your Amazon API key, that you could actually destroy an entire AWS environment, you may not even have, in our system, have to embed that key into your source code. That key could be rooted off of an HSM. You could put a synthetic key in, and then when that key is used by the workload, we'll transpose that to the actual real Amazon API key. So if there's a source code leakage, or if somebody inadvertently leaves some zero-day or unpatched code in their environment, or if even the source code controls are weak and it gets stolen, the actual Amazon AWS API key never leaks. Thus, you don't end up in that situation that there was that kind of thing that was called code spaces. It's the first what I call corporate homicide. Somebody went in and deleted their entire Amazon infrastructure, and 2 weeks later, they were out of business.
Wow.
So you can avoid those situations.
Wow. I hadn't even thought about that. But sure, if everything's up in the cloud, as soon as someone gets a hold of it and deletes it all, if you don't have a way back, you are done.
Yeah, there's no backup. Boy. I can delete all your cloud and all of your backups of your cloud in Amazon and write them over, and there's no restoration path.
Well, this has been a fabulous discussion about Skyport systems, and it's one of those things where, Doug, the deeper we go, the deeper it got and the more little stones I wanted to turn over and dig into, but we're out of time for today. So if I do want to know more, where do I go to learn more about your system?
Well, Ethan, at this point, we're going to cue radio voice to tell you that you can go to info.skyportsystems.net/datanauts. One more time, info.skyportsystems.net/datanauts. We put a bunch of information up there, and obviously it takes you to the rest of the website there. And I'd also say, honestly, ping me on Twitter, hit me on LinkedIn, shoot us an email, anything like that works. If you have any questions, we're really happy to help and look forward to interacting with all of you.
You're pretty socially active, Doug. How can people follow you on Twitter and do you blog somewhere specific and so on?
At dgourlay, D-G-O-U-R-L-A-Y on Twitter. My blog is the Skyport blog, and it's also linked right off of our homepage. And I'm taking some time now to get back into it. I was actually writing something this morning on building an intelligent attack surface, as opposed to sort of a, hey, we dropped some packets, but can't tell you what's in there. Which is why that was kind of top of mind for me today. So, it's very timely today, guys.
Well, good deal. Intelligent attack service is actually one of the points that I had picked out that stuck in my mind as a good term. I like that. Well, let's bring the show to a close. That is it for today's edition of the Datanauts podcast. You can reach me at EC Banks on Twitter. My blog is ethancbanks.com. You can probe Chris at Chris Wall on Twitter, and his blog is wallnetwork.com. For more of our Datanauts shows about infrastructure engineering, nosedive down the rabbit hole that is packetpushers.net. You'll find the Datanauts talking about containers and conferences, certifications, PowerShell, moving to cloud, full stack engineering, storage architecture, and so much more. Until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed.
Sometimes I just feel like you need a little more ego boost, so I let you talk.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah, baby. Let's make this fun.